Heath has moved on in recent years to work on issues related to the financial crisis in Greece, which gave rise to a severe problem for access to healthcare and medications in the country, which in turn gave rise to what Heath is going to be talking about today, social solidarity clinics and pharmacies in Greece. So without any further ado, I warmly welcome Heath Cabot to give her seminar. I only wish we could take you to the pub and dinner afterwards, but with any luck, we'll get that chance next year when you join us at the Collegium for Advanced Studies. So consider it a pleasure delayed, not denied. Heath, on to you.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Yes. Thank you so much, Sarah, for the amazingly kind introduction and for the invitation. In preparing this talk, I was realizing, you know, with this sort of Zoom semester, like, it's just such a pleasure, but also like a kind of nerve-wracking one, actually, to take a moment for one's own work. I feel like it's been a very long time. And so I'm particularly appreciative for you taking the time at a rather late hour to listen to my work in process. So I guess I'll get started I'm gonna just give you a little bit of background about the larger project that this talk is situated in. And that's my second book manuscript. I'm working on it. But you know, there's still a ways to go. And as Sarah was talking about, my earlier work was really an ethnography of Greece's asylum process when Greece was really just starting to become an important entry point into the European Union for various forms of migration. So this was well before 2015-16, but there were already a lot of people coming via the islands and in the north. And so one of the major foci of the book was sort of how the boundary between self and other was inscribed and sort of, and oftentimes contested through the asylum process, and in particular through engagements between lawyers and asylum seekers themselves and the way that cases were built. And I argue that this process did challenge in many ways the presumed homogeneity of Greek citizenship, which is a very pretty strong historically, and I would say still in the present. But at the end of the book, this was in 2013, so the consequences of the debt crisis were still very much sort of emergent, I would say. And I sort of asked at the end of the book what was happening to citizenship more broadly. Under austerity, as rights and entitlements were being very clearly eroded. And so I sort of asked, is citizenship kind of more and more up for grabs? Is this boundary between self and other alien citizen being challenged in new ways? And so I guess this second project really does pick up on where that left off. And so the book, and it really focuses, I'm going to be talking very specifically about the social clinics and pharmacies, which are a very specific kind of intervention that sort of boomed under austerity. But the larger focus of the book is really about two things. I guess I make an argument that Greece is just one node in a more global remaking of citizenship in late capitalism, which is becoming characterized by multiple forms of displacement, oftentimes in place. Okay, and so I'm working really with trying to also de-exceptionalize the way that we think of displacement as being cross-border movement. But I really look at how I'm working mostly with Greek citizens and long-term residents, not Syrian refugees or anything like that, but I really look at how their lives and livelihoods have been increasingly unmoored from the terrain of rights and entitlements, how kinship and social networks have been fragmented. And also I'm very interested in looking at the unsettling of futures and life trajectories. And at Athens, I try to argue has become increasingly a site of the uncanny, where home is ruptured and made strange. So these are some of the larger themes that constitute the backdrop of the book, but the focus is really on a grassroots attempt to engender forms of healing and repair in these forms of displacement. And these ruptures of social connections and this dismantling of the state of rights, or even the dream of the state of rights. So that's the kind of the, That's the backdrop. The focus though is on this very innovative, I think, approach to managing what Sarah rightly called attention to as the sort of urgent state, what became sort of urgent state of the healthcare system in Greece, where many more and more people were unemployed and actually barred from being able to access healthcare, which at the time, at least until 2016, was directly linked to employment and the pension fund that you or in your employer would actually pay into. And so this left a lot of people uninsured, and also a great many people had been accustomed to paying for private care and no longer had that sort of economic capacity. So the social clinics and pharmacies are just one form of what became known as the Greek Solidarity Movement, or Kinema Allelengis, and they're really forms of mutual aid. And it's so interesting to see this term mutual aid being leveraged even now in my neighborhood in Pittsburgh during with COVID. Okay. But these were they're different. There's there are soup kitchens, there are groceries, there are time banks, different forms of sort of reciprocal economies, but also economies of redistribution, which is what characterizes the social clinics. And I zeroed in on the social clinics primarily because well, they seem so counterintuitive. This what I always thought of as this kind of expert realm of healthcare, like pharmacies and doctors, et cetera, being something that was happening as a kind of grassroots insurgent, in a way, movement or intervention. And there, I just want to note a few of the, I think, more innovative aspects of these. There are a great many more. I'm happy to talk about it. So the main thing that's interesting is how pharmaceuticals and care are redistributed. So healthcare professionals offer voluntary labor. Oftentimes you have retired healthcare professionals offering appointments at these places or via a network of doctors and healthcare professionals and clinics. In terms of pharmaceuticals, which has been kind of more my focus, I guess, they're brought by people in the neighborhood. Sometimes private pharmacies will say, hey, when you're done, if you have any left over, bring it back. I'll take that to a social pharmacy. They're donated from warehouses of pharmaceutical companies when they're about to expire. This is something that's become more typical recently. In some cases, they're purchased, particularly in the case of very specific forms of medicine, like a very specific kind of antipsychotic or cancer treatments. So, and this is a kind of contested issue because credit and money is a very problematic issue in these sites that are supposed to be grounded entirely on solidarity. And redistribution economies. They're acquired through listserv. So there's a whole listserv linking all of the social pharmacies in Greece. At one point, there was something like 57. And so they could be transported, specifically specific medicines. And they're also collected from other European countries. And here's a van that had brought a bunch of medicine from Germany. And I did research with my friend over here, Salvatore, who's also participating or listening in today. We did some research in Italy as well, where there was a lot of sort of mobilizing to collect and donate pharmaceuticals in support of Greece, which I think a lot of Europeans felt had unfairly gotten the brunt of austerity. In terms of the fieldwork, I was lucky to have a Fulbright grant in 2015 and a very short sabbatical at my previous institution in 2016. So I will say that the majority of my research was done at that time, but I've been able to go back every summer, but this past one, to do follow-up research. And so I really focused on a couple of pharmacies that were in the Athens area. But I also did visit a bunch of other social pharmacies, including one of the oldest ones in Thessaloniki and some others in the north. Pulling up my I really sought to avoid some of the more populated areas, I guess. This was a challenge that was new to me. Having worked in Greece before the debt crisis and before the refugee crisis, I had a lot of anonymity and freedom. I was like in my little village, my little, to do my research. And this was not the case when I began this project. Greece had become a place a lot of people were moving in order to be sort of engaged in political action. A lot of researchers were doing work there, as well as on these issues related to the social pharmacies. And so I tried to avoid some of the more, let's say, central, maybe more famous of these initiatives, partially for that reason. And one of them, like the largest one that's near Athens, one of the volunteers described it as a tourist stop right after the Acropolis. So that sort of attests to the sort of, I mean, they would have people coming in every day, which, you know, I think was just a bit disruptive. And it made me uncomfortable for a lot of reasons, some of them good, some of them not so good. But so like, let's be honest, like most of us, I came upon my field sites in a very serendipitous fashion, I will say. But I chose to focus on two very different social clinics. Well, actually one's more a pharmacy. One is almost entirely a pharmacy. The other one is a clinic and a pharmacy that really showed me the extremely different ways in which different groups of people, even very close to each other in proximity, were approaching this project. But also it was allowed me to look at some of the overarching or cross-cutting ways in which solidarity was being performed and practiced in the social clinics. So one of the sites was in very central Athens. There are a bunch of these initiatives in the municipality of Athens, but this one was really right in the heart of the city center. And as you can see, it's a very clinical space. This is the dental office over here on the left. You can't see it, but there were a bunch of sort of areas where doctors, private spaces where doctors could conduct examinations, like a gynecologist, an ear, nose, and throat doctor, pulmonologist, right? I think that's the term, right? So they had some specialists. They rented the space, and this was a pretty high-end space, so that, you know, well, as I mentioned, money is difficult to talk about oftentimes. There was financial support coming from groups outside of Greece, in particular Germany, France, and also Finland, apparently. And so the social pharmacy of Vironas, which is a municipality that is outside of Athens, but Vironas is really basically in the heart of Athens. You can walk to the very city center in about 45 minutes. And it's a working class, historically leftist neighborhood. This group here, you can kind of tell, right? It's a very different operation than what's going on in this other clinic. They're mostly older people. It was the first site they had was in the empty apartment of one of the owners. They didn't have electricity. They then moved to another apartment that was also the property of somebody, one of the volunteers. And it was at their most, they had 25 to 30, and they only focused on pharmaceuticals. They were usually open. They had very extensive hours, and even though they were small, they were very effective at sourcing pharmaceuticals. So they would get visitors from not just the neighborhood, but even from outside of Athens coming here because they were open every day. And that wasn't necessarily the case for every pharmacy. In any case, those are some of the specifics of sort of the background, the methods that inform the project. I guess I just want to run through some of the overarching themes I've been looking at and then sort of dive into my focus for today. So I guess one thing that's been that I think it's hard not to explore when you're looking at the Greek solidarity movement is solidarity as a kind of ideology. That has been explicitly politicized. Sort of the idea that solidarity is about, it's a very worker solidarity, right? It's a very sort of Marxist discourse. It's a very, this idea that solidarity and struggle are the things that are gonna hold us together. And this explicit politicization is counterposed by Katerina Rozaku, who's been writing about solidarity since it started to emerge as a discourse like in the late 90s, actually. that it's framed as a kind of militant voluntarism, which is very much seen by people practicing it as against like humanitarian work or charity or the Red Cross. So it's like framed as explicitly political with very specific kinds of ideological content. Okay. But beneath that, I think oftentimes the over-focus on the political discourse of solidarity can actually elide some of the more interesting aspects of it. So I've been looking at solidarity as a form of social healing, the way that people engaged in these projects have sought to sort of not just to address issues of bodily health, but also social health through different interventions into the social body. And today I'm going to talk about bureaucratic interventions as a mode of healing or as an attempt to heal. But more broadly, there's a vision of repairing and remaking sociality. Okay, but when I talk about solidarity as farmaco, which is solidarity as medicine, which I've heard people describe it as, it also has that two-edged nature that I guess Derrida or Plato long before him called attention to. And that's the kind of the dual aspect of the confusion between the Greek term, for instance, pharmako and pharmaki, right? So medicine and poison, the way in which the medicine itself can oftentimes become the poison and vice versa, right? So the poison can sometimes become a kind of antidote. And that's something that is, I would say, that's going to be a theme for my talk today. The way in which something that's meant to be healing can sometimes also become malevolent or even malignant. I've talked a little bit about solidarity as organizational and innovation. I focus a lot on the sort of different ways in which pharmaceuticals are sourced. And I want to emphasize that these are really interesting, and they are real innovations in the way I think care is distributed. And I guess another red thread of the book is really what one of my interlocutors called the Janus face of solidarity, the way that there are these structuring tensions throughout the project that people active in the social clinics and pharmacies are anything but naive to, but actually discuss and work to deal with all the time. So they're very much things that people consider and bring into their everyday practice and conversation. And one of them is how solidarity projects are meant to resist austerity, and yet they all sort of, everybody active in it would probably recognize that they actually contribute to outsourcing care. Another tension is how they resist humanitarianism, charity, all these more traditional forms of providing services. And they work really hard to, you know, have that political, politicized approach. And yet, as others have also written, they're working alongside humanitarian initiatives, and they're part of this larger non-state apparatus of care and service provision that is sort of taken over in Greece. The apolitical and the political, this is something that I just kind of want to flag because it's one of the things I find more interesting. That over-focus on the political discourse of solidarity as ideology, actually, I found that it really erases a lot of the labor that goes into making solidarity work. And that is usually the labor of retired women or unemployed women or men who've been feminized in the sense that they're unemployed. And a great many of those active in the movement don't actively claim themselves to, or actively would say they're not active political subjects, right? So I think that the over-focus on an articulated vision of the political actually erases a lot of what's happening in the movement. And I guess, that, so in that sense, I guess I'm looking at the gender of the political, so to speak, to kind of put a twist on Marilyn Strathairn's work. And finally, the focus of my talk today, which is that they worked against the state, but they also tried to remake it in a way from below. Okay. So that's the sort of backdrop. And now I'm going to go into presenting part of an in-process chapter, which is, I believe, the fourth chapter of the book. Okay. The young man was brooding in quiet with the messy beard and black t-shirt of young people active in radical left circles in Greece. It was spring 2016. Actually, yes, 2016, not May 2017. Anyway, and I'd pulled him out of the waiting room in the Athens clinic on a day when the work was behind schedule to ask him why he'd come to seek care there as opposed to a more formal healthcare venue. He had, to my surprise, agreed, primarily to pass the time as he was waiting to see the doctor. He was soft-spoken, even sullen, but we both laughed heartily at the beauty of this invented word with his pathologizing connotations, which tied together the Greek for bureaucracy, meaning grapho, and of course, fear, phobos. So he was describing to me, he used this term, he said, "I have graphophobia. I am afraid of bureaucracy." Okay. So he'd admitted frankly that he knew that he had the right to access public health services, but that he'd never really considered them to be legitimate alternatives to the private system. He'd always been accustomed to paying for private care or having his parents pay for it. But then he moved to Athens on his own and he'd begun a master's degree and got a job working in an office in the Syriza campaign. But he'd recently lost the job and he was now had a part-time position in a call center, which paid only 300 euros a month, and his employers did not pay the necessary taxes to insure their employees, who were working basically all of them informally. And so he was employed, albeit precariously, but nonetheless uninsured. And it was at this point that because he was so anxious to visit the public system and unable to pay for the private, that he began visiting the social clinics, and they became really sort of important institutions in his care seeking. Mostly for just small things, he said, like a cold or when he needed medicine. Now, as I mentioned before, we know that the way in which healthcare used to be organized, it was really tied to formal employment and the paying of into pension funds where people's insurance would come from. Okay, but in the spring of 2016, right before I did this interview with this young man, the Syriza government had passed a law, which was referred to colloquially in my field sites as the new law, which, as one volunteer put it, rendered the uninsured insured, making it possible for anyone with a social security number, okay, AMCA, to access the public health system without having to pay. And I'm going to note that the current Greek government has rolled the effects of this law back significantly. And anyway, this was a really huge reform. And the social clinics that both of my field sites were very excited about it. And volunteers at the Athens clinic had put up a sign in the waiting room to inform patients of their new rights. Now, noting the sign, the young man explained that he was aware of the new law. He described himself as a highly politicized person. He was very active. He knew what was going on in the public sphere. But it was at this point that he talked about his graphophobia and his reluctance to visit a public clinic. And he added that he would likely need to face this phobos at some point because he anticipated that with the new law, the social pharmacies would start more aggressively to, quote, send Greeks away from the social clinics, okay? Since all Greeks have AMCA. And so he started, and he thought this was appropriate, but he didn't want to have to deal with this yet. So that day, the young man received his care as he always had before, but this comment that they will start sending Greeks away proved prescient. That spring and summer, numerous social clinics, including both my field sites, began to institute additional eligibility procedures meant to encourage patients to seek care at public venues. The screening measures were themselves centered on paperwork, documents, and other bureaucratic elements through which patients' needs were assessed and access granted or revoked. So while there were variations on these eligibility frameworks, and there was always space for discretionary power, I watched solidarity become increasingly bureaucratized itself. Okay. Even with this backdrop of fear of public bureaucracy, solidarity became increasingly bureaucratized. And that's kind of the, I'm not going to say paradox, but that's the tension that I'm looking at in this chapter. Okay, so this account certainly highlights those dominant aspects of fear and anxiety that I think most would agree are pretty powerful in Greek accounts of and encounters with the state. The state is not your friend. Okay. But even as solidarity initiatives frame their work as outside or sometimes contra the state, okay, They actually worked, we see here, okay, they actually worked alongside and oftentimes in tandem with public services, right? They're responding to what's happening in the policy realm. They're working with the, as part of a wider healthcare body, let's say, or infrastructure in Greece. Okay, so as we know, states are not bounded entities, of course. And I love this metaphor of the construction site from this book, States at Work, that really calls attention to states more as projects that consist of actors that are both formally and informally marked as the state. And of course, the solidarity initiatives, okay, even if they're not formally the state, they engage in the work of stateness because they are forms of welfare from below, to cite Theodorakopoulos' work on solidarity. And the work of stateness is about gatekeeping access to crucial services, right? So distributing this welfare dimension of distributing services, but also policing or gatekeeping access to it. And so solidarity was also subject to the work of administration and regulation in order to facilitate this kind of gatekeeping. But rather than simply mimicking or replicating state bureaucratic practices, which were the source of this young man's phobos, let's say, right? Those sort of negative ideas of bureaucracy, the social clinics really sought to produce this different, more positive, let's say, or benevolent bureaucratic ethos, as opposed to that which had engendered fear. And this was in part a way to ward off the malevolence associated with Greek public bureaucracies, but it was also a way to train patients themselves to become bureaucratically competent citizens and to co-opt them into the project of remaking the state from below. And this is one of a great many ways in which the social clinics sought to make healing interventions into the social. In this case, they weaponize bureaucratic forms for good, so to speak, to counteract uncertainty with predictability and reliability, opacity with transparency, corruption and complicity with rights and the state of law. This was the goal, at least. But these positive or benevolent, forms of bureaucraft, in the words of Erica Capel James, also had divisive or malevolent effects in the social, which undermines the project of solidarity from within. And this is one of those things that goes back to that Janus face of solidarity that I referenced earlier. Okay, so bureaucratic forms bridge the material and the social and are premised upon a presumed effectivity in how this relationship is practiced and performed. Now, Erica Capel James, this is a wonderful article. It came out in 2012, and it's Cultural Anthropology, and it's about her work on humanitarian and healthcare extra state interventions in Haiti. Okay, so a very different context. But I have to say that a lot of her accounts are definitely reminiscent of the kinds of powers that I would say my interlocutors ascribe to bureaucracy, both benevolent and malevolent, and in some cases, becoming even almost phantasmagorical or frightening in their accounts. And so I saw this as a useful way to sort of, I took this as an inspiration to see what magic, okay, what magic could help me see if applied a little bit more extensively to my analysis of bureaucratic work. And so I want to emphasize that I'm not so much focused on what magic is per se as drawing upon it as a model to illuminate certain aspects of how bureaucracy works and the logics behind it. Okay, so one of the things that I think is relevant to the context in which I was working is I pull from the work of Ernesto De Martino, who's the Italian anthropologist who did research on magic in the Italian South, specifically forms of binding magic. And he really makes this point that magic's particularly powerful, okay, in contexts where uncertainty and precariousness have become the norm and where the idea of human as rational operator does not work because everything goes wrong with predictability. And so I think this is pretty apt, this is an apt description of life in Greece under austerity, for sure. Okay, so that was the first thing. The second thing, though, is that that if we think about magic as being grounded, of course, on complex chains of causation that are really hard to unpack and get at with just access to rationality, right? They also open up possibilities for bureaucratic work. Okay, so Michael Hertzfeld talks about how bureaucrats work on the categories of social existence in much the same way as sorcerers work on the hair or nail clippings of their intended victims. And so a panel I was on a few years ago with Annick Bolberg and her friend, I forgot her last name, Marchese, they really open up this idea of thinking about magical tinkering, the way in which social service bureaucracies entail a kind of tinkering with or playing with the social through bureaucratic projects. And so so through bureaucracy and through bureaucraft, okay, the social can be worked on, tinkered with, and intervened in, either or perhaps both, in this case, malevolent and healing effects. Okay. So in terms of the malevolence and the source of the young man's graphophobia that I referenced earlier, of course, malevolent bureaucraft is oftentimes ascribed to the Greek state. Okay, I have more accounts than I know what to do with, having worked around Greek bureaucracy since like 2004, of this kind of negative, or I would say even malignant sort of power that many, many asylum seekers, foreigners, and Greeks alike will ascribe to the state and encounters with bureaucracies in particular. So Vangelis, who was a founding member of the Virona social pharmacy, talked about how if you go to a sub-public office, they'll look at you as if you're an enemy, right? And so this really pulls to the fore or brings to the fore a Greek state idea or image that is not about, it's not your friend, right? It's about unity and disunity, chaos, arbitrariness, and even malintent, okay? So these were dominant ways in which my interlocutors over the years, but also Greek citizens, right, frame their encounters with state bureaucracies. So, for instance, Maria, a longtime beneficiary of numerous solidarity initiatives, who's been homeless on and off since 2011, told me about her ongoing struggles with the tax office. Despite her unemployment card that had entitled her to pay no taxes, she was told again and again that she owed back taxes, but every time she visited the office, she was given a different balance. She had a similarly frustrating odyssey in trying to renew her healthcare booklet, which, because she was below the poverty line, should have entitled her to medicines with no cost. She started trying to renew the booklet well before it expired, but while it was in process, it expired. and she finally learned after numerous trips to the relevant office, in the meantime, she couldn't go to the hospital because she didn't have a booklet. She was told that her file had gotten lost because while it was being transferred to another office, and so she had to reapply. And so at this point, she sort of looked at me like, how do you just lose someone's file? Does it really just fall off someone's motorbike? Right. So she highlighted this kind of uncertainty and mystification around the process, but also this kind of vague sense of malintent that it was almost as if some keeper of the keys in the system had somehow decided against her. Now, Vangelis, who was a founding member of the Virona Pharmacy, who's an 82-year-old, I think now 83, former merchant marine and longtime union organizer. He told me that these kinds of bureaucratic misadventures were really part of a master plan. That the state, quote, keeps people confused on purpose. And that's why the workers' and that's why, of course, the workers' movement has been diminished, of course, because with him, it always came back to the workers. And so he said, people look over here and over there and they have no idea what's going on. But even though Vangelis had this kind of more macro analysis of what was going on behind, what was behind these kinds of malevolent kind of encounters, he also had just gave, would give descriptions of public services that emphasized their malevolent and phantasmagorical, in many cases, qualities. So a particularly powerful example was how he told me about the quote, disappearing home healthcare office in the municipal building of Vironas. And home healthcare is for people, I guess, people who can't leave the house and who need to receive care at home. said, no, every time he would go, he'd try to go frequently in order to make complaints on behalf of patients of the social pharmacy, but no one was ever in. And sometimes there was a sign on the door indicating that was the office, and sometimes the sign would disappear. And so it was this kind of just like, you know, the disappearing file, there was the disappearing home healthcare office. So public services were not just not there, okay? Sometimes they would be actively against you in the case of the earlier quote about the enemy, but other times they just would not be there and they'd appear and disappear at will in ways that really impacted care. So we see that both Maria and Vangelis have given these accounts of their encounters with negative or malevolent aspects of bureaucracy. But it's also relevant that they both, in different ways, sought to perform counter strategies meant to manage, ward off, or even rectify this kind of malevolent bureaucrat that they had encountered. So for instance, Maria at the tax office, right? So she's not just a victim of bureaucracy, she's actually working really hard. She's working really hard to go to the tax office to report her income. She is acting as a sort of ideal bureaucratic citizen, even if they're not doing so, right? So similarly, Vangelis, right, as through his work at the social clinic, he actually became a real champion of transparency, as I'll show in just a minute. But they were trying, through his work and the work they were doing more broadly, it was really focused again on, and I'll show in just a sec, on trying to counter this counter, it was almost a counter magic of bureaucracy that was being employed in the social clinics as a way to sort of ward off the malevolence associated with the state. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit more what this looks like in practice. In early summer 2016, this was also after the new law that I told you about before, an older woman came into the Vironas pharmacy bundled in a warm coat, saying she couldn't bend her arm. I later learned that she was of Albanian descent and had moved to Greece in the 1990s, where all of her children had been born. She asked for help getting a doctor's appointment, but since there was no rheumatologist active in the network of doctors, the volunteers gave her information for how to go and make an appointment in the local public clinic. She protested. She was in significant pain and she didn't want to have to deal with the bureaucracy, the graphocratia, right? She too was afraid. And she was particularly afraid that she wouldn't be able to get an appointment in a reasonable amount of time and that it would tire her out. She was afraid of the courtesy, the tiredness that was going to impact her if she went to a public clinic. I have something urgent, she said, and sometimes it takes over a month to get an appointment. The volunteers, all of whom were women of a similar age, fussed over her, sort of sympathizing, but also reprimanding her for her reticence to seek care. They brought out the names of reputable physical therapists and the pharmacist on duty, gave her some medicine to help with the pain. But Sula, one of the core and founding members of the Vironas Pharmacy and Vangelis' partner, I'm just gonna put that out there because it's relevant. She added a directive in a tone that was both critical and encouraging, saying, you know, you really need to go to the public clinic. And then she followed it up with this statement, do your work. Kanatin duliashu. Okay, and that was it. Now, after the woman left, another volunteer explained to me that people are afraid, okay, vovunde, and they don't want to deal with the bureaucracy, but they still have to go. But it was interesting. 2 weeks later, I ran into this woman at the pharmacy and I was like, how did it go at the public clinic? And she sort of looked at me like, what are you talking about? And then I reminded her and then she just laughed at me. I mean, she was not only not going to go, I sounded like an idiot for even asking her for whether she went. So I think that kind of says a little something about about her attitude towards that. Okay, now so the work that Sula speaks of is in fact an extension of what many saw as the work of the pharmacy, okay? To push the public system and the state to fulfill its responsibilities. They must demand their rights. This was a refrain I heard again and again. Otherwise, if the patients, don't demand their rights, the system will never work the way it's supposed to. So rights in this framing are not entitlements that one simply has, but are contingent on the labor, the work of an active, activated citizenry. And this pragmatic work of citizenship wasn't restricted to the able-bodied or even to native Greek citizens, at least in the social clinics. It was meant to extend to all those who sought care. So volunteers pressed the patients to press the system to do the work, right? To do its own work. But enlisting them in this wider project was really challenging owing to that entrenched graphophobia and the malevolence so often associated with the public services and the state. Vangelis, for instance, told me many times over that his biggest regret was how little they'd been able to get beneficiaries of the pharmacy to themselves become active in some way in the pharmacy. He complained that most of them were there just to receive things with this kind of service mentality. And so a harder, more emphatic mode of activation, okay, of training citizens, was employed through bureaucratic interventions governing access and eligibility. And so let me tell you a little bit about this. So in the Vieronas pharmacy, and I guess this is Sula sitting behind the desk, I want to call attention to the sort of elegant offline character of everything. They didn't have well, most of the volunteers are older, don't necessarily have access to computer, cell phone, that kind of thing. That's changed in the last year or two. There's a ledger here where every visitor is recorded, the amount of medicine. There are about three or four boxes up here that have index cards with all of those registered, those people who receive medicine regularly from the Vieronas pharmacy. There were one-offs who come in, and usually they were given assistance. But if anyone wanted to receive medicines on a regular basis, there they had to register. And in order to register, and this was really, I think this was Dimitri's idea. Sorry, Vangelis' idea. It's okay. They had to actually make a tax statement, like go and declare their income at the tax office, and then bring the tax statement in to the pharmacy in order to show that they had no income, basically, no assets or no money-making assets. And so it was kind of a little tricky move here, because this meant that if you wanted to receive care there, you had to go declare your income and do a tax statement, which, let me just say, was not always the norm. It's not even always the norm here. So, but it also had a particular kind of moral significance at a time when the idea of Greeks tax dodging and not declaring their income had been part of the larger national and international discourse surrounding the debt crisis. Okay, so this was a clear bureaucratic intervention that meant to train or insist that patients behave in a particularly prescribed, transparent, bureaucratic fashion. Now, they also if anybody wanted to give someone medicine, you always had the discretion to do that. But I would say, having tried to do that on a couple of occasions, it was not always the most, because I was working as a volunteer as well, it was not always the most accepted. Okay, so we've already talked a little bit about the Athens clinic and the sort of increasingly restrictive way in which they started approaching issues of eligibility. When I first started going there, it was all about, oh, it's on good faith, like we give people help, because why would they be here if they didn't need help? But after the passage of the new law, and I will also say after the sort of massive influx of people who ended up being in need in 2015-16, there was a real shift, right? Turning Greeks away and actually focusing more and more on people who did not have AMCA initially, right, who did not have a social security number, and those are migrants and refugees. And so by the time this used to be sort of like encouraged, like you should really go to the public system, to really a policy. By the time I last was there in 2018, you would see like this sort of post-it note posted near the phone. There were signs, etc. To volunteers, please, when you schedule an appointment, okay, ask if they have AMCA. If yes, they go to the state, okay? So it was a very clear kind of policy at that point. And of course, people tried to get around it, and there were moments where they would sort of assist people anyway, but this was the sort of the way in which it had bureaucratized into a very clear delineation of who was entitled and who was not. And the vast majority of people were not entitled. So this openness of solidarity, right, was being bureaucratized and regulated in a fairly restricted fashion. Okay, So despite these sort of positive, let's say, or benevolent, well, let's say positive bureaucratic interventions, right, meant to co-opt patients themselves into kind of making the state also do its work, right? They nonetheless, these bureaucratic interventions oftentimes had their own divisive effects. And for instance, many care seekers, like this woman I told you about, still resisted visiting the public system. Others failed or refused to comply with the bureaucratic ethos that the social clinics tried to require. And patients often sometimes, often approach the social clinics themselves with graphophobia, with fear, because they found themselves sort of afraid of the bureaucracies that they encountered in solidarity spaces. And I think a particularly illustrative example is this man I ran into one day at the Vidones pharmacy, who pulled out, he had this huge like plastic bag full of documents that had all been sort of carefully filed, and he took out a tax statement, an unemployment card, either of which would have easily qualified him forever to receive medicine from the Vidones pharmacy. But then he started taking out bills, unpaid bills, unpaid rent, sort of statement saying he hadn't paid his rent for a few months, formal certifications from public services saying that he owed a certain amount. So this guy was just absolutely demonstrating his need bureaucratically in every possible way. And Effie, this other volunteer, came over. She sort of, the poor guy got me, the foreigner, so he was doubly anxious. But she was like, you know, it's fine. Like, don't worry, you're going to be okay. Right. But I think this anxiety, as well as this kind of over demonstration of bureaucratic competence, shows that sort of persistence of graphophobia and how it also became directed at solidarity bureaucracies themselves. Now, I would say that this guy was not the norm. Like, he was a pretty strong example of someone who was extremely overprepared. A great many others were much less successful in their bureaucratic presentations of self, and in some cases were outright hostile to eligibility procedures. And these individuals sometimes became subject to moral critiques and explicitly disciplinary interventions at the social clinics, which generated frustration, suspicion, and mistrust. Okay. So I'm going to just tell you just about briefly about a particularly memorable encounter. Was when Vangelis turned a couple away for what he saw as a lack of transparency in the tax statement. So they brought a tax statement. They'd been receiving medicine at the Vidones pharmacy for a long time, but he didn't like what he saw on the tax statement because he cited their ownership of a car and a couple of unrented properties. And he sort of raised this issue, saying, "You're not going to receive medicines here because, like, you must have assets that you're not telling me about. Otherwise, how can you pay for the plates and the gasoline? And how can you keep those properties going?" Now, I'm not going to weigh in on the accuracy of his reading of this, okay? But it was interesting that, you know, he had a sort of hermeneutics of what he had a certain process that through which he was, excuse me, approaching the tax statement. The man responded very aggressively, yelling and saying that he was entitled to medicines, that he couldn't turn him away because this was a quote public service. And of course, Vangelis got even more angry, and he said, "We have nothing to do with the public. We have nothing to do with the state. We run on solidarity." Okay, so in the end, they did not receive medicine, and the couple left in a huff. Now, afterwards, I sat with him and Sula and debriefed the encounter. She pointed out gently that they regularly gave out medicines to people who had cars, sometimes cars parked right outside. And she suggested also gently that wasn't it really because of their behavior, logos in periphoras, that Vangelis had turned them away? And he kind of nodded, like, yeah, maybe. But then he added this, that he knew that the couple used to have a store, and he knew that they used to hire a lot of workers informally. And so it seems that in part he'd enlisted the bureaucracy at the pharmacy in order to discipline this man for his poor history of citizenship and poor bureaucratic citizenship in the past as well, and presumably also to reward others. Sula commented, "It's difficult." Okay. And she said, "It's great to have," I mean, she talked about how it was great to have flexibility to make decisions like this, but that such inconsistencies were also problematic because, she said, people talk. Okay. Implying that this couple would compare notes with others and then go out into the neighborhood and sow suspicion about the work of the pharmacy. So despite the social clinic's attempts at positive bureaucraft, their bureaucratic interventions generated and also reflected these kinds of divisive socialities that also extended beyond the boundaries of the clinics into the communities themselves and into community relations. And talk, in fact, or gossip, let's call it, also played an important role in this divisiveness. Now, Ksenia is a really close interlocutor, and she's also a friend, and we've conducted multiple interviews. She's become a friend over the years since I started this project. And she, the very first time I interviewed her about her experience visiting various public clinics, social clinics, she really was very complimentary, saying they do this really important public service, this liturgima, without pay, for free. Right. And she, unlike a lot of other people, understood the voluntary nature of these initiatives. And so she, you know, she's super complimentary. Bravo tus, good job, etc. But this was again the first time we discussed this, she got really awkward, and you could tell she wasn't sure whether she wanted to share something. But she said that she'd stopped going to one of the social clinics she used to frequent a lot. After one of the volunteers, a man had made her feel uncomfortable by always commenting on her beauty and touching her on multiple occasions. Nothing overtly problematic, but you know, this kind of thing, right? And so she had stopped going because she felt so uncomfortable. She asked me pointedly at that point if I knew what kerdos means. I nodded. It means profit. She went on to say that a public service is supposed to be without profit. And if you really want to help someone, you're not supposed to display your help to the one you're helping. One hand shouldn't know what the other does. And every month she tops up her unemployed nephew's mobile phone anonymously without him knowing. And she left her commentary at that. Now, Ksenia is a deeply religious person, and she always made a point to avoid outright gossip in our meetings. And of course, gossip is a form of talk that is explicitly dangerous in Greece, in particular. A few years after our initial interview, Ksenia's son was in a terrible accident. He was actually wonderfully treated at a public hospital. She told me later that some cousins had been talking about his success at the very moment when the car hit him. So this was a clear reference to the evil eye at work, the mati, a belief common throughout Southern Europe, the Balkans, Middle East, that bad luck, injury, and illness are transmitted through jealousy and gossip. Ksenia nonetheless talked, right? Even if she's not overtly gossiping, conveying not just a sense of betrayal, but also her own critique about how the social clinics were distributing services and pointing to aspects of corruption and even abuse. Now, talk also reflected divisive socialities between beneficiaries themselves, particularly around these same issues of access and distribution. Maria, who we met earlier, complained to me that the thing she disliked the most about going to solidarity initiatives, even though she couldn't survive without them, was how everyone complained about each other, what people wore, who had relationships with each other, like where they lived, whether they were good parents, everything. Some complained that others took more than they needed, that people from Albania or Bulgaria, for instance, should not have the same access as Greeks, for instance. So there was all this that really bothered her. And so these kinds of divisive socialities really undermine that sense of openness, fairness, and transparency that the clinics had really sought to instantiate through their bureaucratic interventions. And so in this talk, we see really is reflecting a kind of malevolence that's happening in the social sphere, both within and outside the pharmacies, despite their healing interventions, right? I stood with Marius and Despina one afternoon outside a neighborhood supermarket, asking shoppers to offer food to be redistributed in the Solidarity Initiative where they were active. Oh, I see it. Is it a time? Are you giving me a time warning? Okay, I'm almost done. I'm in the very end. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Vespino was a volunteer, but Marius was also a beneficiary. Okay, so he was also a beneficiary of the social pharmacy of Vironas. Vespino was complaining about how there was so much gossip happening within their solidarity initiative, both between beneficiaries and also volunteers. And at this point, Marius became very animated, explaining that he was just always a subject of gossip and talk because he was a foreigner. And this was the thing he hated the most about living in Greece. He added that he could hear people talking, right? Even when he and his family go to church in order to light candles. He then switched his discourse to the malevolence of the evil eye, underscoring the danger of talk. His sister, a beautiful little girl who died as a child because she drank poison. Someone must have been commenting on her beauty. He didn't know whom. The local crone in his village in Albania who commented on how beautiful their little kitten was, and the kitten died immediately. Vespina kind of scoffed. She said, you know, she wasn't superstitious, but if you believe in such things, they will come to pass. But Marius maintained that he was always careful not to talk about others and also to protect himself. Now the social clinics focus on healing and repair, okay? The bureaucraft, the positive bureaucraft meant to govern access and distribution, they still got caught up in and also generated wider malevolent socialities. The evil eye and the rituals that ward it off and heal the affliction that it's supposed to bring are forms of binding magic that are also paradigmatic of these kinds of divisive social relationships. And like solidarity, the mati is also premised on an effective relationship between the health of the social and individual bodily health. Now, a healing ritual is necessary, okay, to cure the person afflicted with the evil eye. And I was often subject to this healing ritual when I was out of sorts. And Sula herself, who was trained in it, was when she was afflicted, you would see some of her cold volunteers whispering incantations and prayers in the back of the social pharmacy, yawning widely as the affliction departed. While not a healing ritual per se, solidarity is a healing mode of sociality that is also meant to have healing impacts, okay, on bodily health. But even as they sought to make benevolent and healing interventions through medicine and bureaucracy, dangerous socialities, sometimes even almost magically, trickled into the space of solidarity, whether through looks, suspicion, fear, or talk. And this malevolence also corrupted the magic, so to speak, of solidarity. Okay, I'm done. Hope that wasn't...
So, perfectly timed. Thank you very much. That was great. One of the really unfortunate things of Zoom is we can't...
I know. Tell if it was funny. You can't tell if it was like wasn't a good one, but hey.
But excellent. And have a bunch of questions while people are finding their thoughts. One of them here is about the outsiders. The social solidarity that you're describing here, there seem to be a variety or layerings of outsiders, if you like, of different kinds of people who felt either through graphophobia, the fear of bureaucracy, that the state wasn't for them. I mean, sort of slightly almost echoing Campbell's stuff on the Sarkozani and their
Absolutely.
Terror of the bureaucratic process and the need to rely on other people to kind of mediate. So from that, and to the ones that you kind of, I'm wondering whether there are some people for whom not even the solidarity clinics were available. So they would... And you hinted a little bit about that, about, you know, the kind of moral judgments of Vangelis Dimitri, whatever his name was, in Vironas that there are certain kinds of barriers. So I was wondering whether it's just my being steeped in classical ancient Greek ethnography that makes me feel like I'm recognizing here something that has been written about for a while in Greece, which is this kind of various, very, very strong sense of outsiderness, which sometimes includes almost, you know, the entire population. Hertzfeldt has written that, and sometimes includes certain groups, and the degree to which that plays out in people's sense of the state. I had a couple of other questions about the kind of Kafkaesque, the fetishization of endlessly collecting documents, which is something I also recognize in people, the piling them up. But I'll leave it at that for now. And people should just put their blue hands up so I can see that they're wanting to ask questions. Okay, two have already done so. Yeah. So first to let you answer that, Heath, and then I'm going to...
No, so by no means would I say that, like, I'm trying to make, just be very clear, like, absolutely, this is something that I think has been written about. I mean, I wrote about it in my earlier book, but way before that, certainly it's an ongoing theme in Greek ethnography, and thinking about outsiderness and how this shapes relationships with the state. Referring specifically to, I guess, the people I encountered, one thing that's, I guess, important to flag, I guess I'm just going to talk about it just briefly about, like, care seeking. So people who didn't have access to services at first, or maybe they did, but didn't have the, maybe they couldn't travel very well or were disabled in some capacity. There wasn't a lot of support. And so the social clinics were just one among a much, like, wider, like, circuitous sort of network, I would say, of places that people would go to get what they needed, right? And so, I mean, I think Salvatore always makes this point that, you know, it's really exhausting to be poor. And I mean, this was a full-time job. And oftentimes it was interesting. I would see a lot of the same people at both my field sites, because if they didn't have a certain medicine in one place, they'd go to another place. And so this kind of cobbled together quality of care was something that, I don't know, I don't think there were any clear boundaries between insiderness and outsiderness in this, in the sense that, of course, like, everybody, going to the social pharmacies was already an outsider on a certain level, right? So part of the goal of solidarity was actually to create a venue through which people who had been abandoned either by the state or by kin, oftentimes as well. So a lot of kinship relationships, a lot of people I encountered who were sort of constant patients of the social clinics. A lot of women who were single mothers, a lot of men who were divorced and alone. I mean, this is where the sort of fragmentation of the social also comes to bear. And the whole idea of solidarity is it's something bigger than kinship. It's something bigger than it's something bigger than the nation. It's something that everyone is welcome to, right? That's the idea. Okay. But as we saw, I mean, this really changed over time, and also changed in a situational fashion too, as solidarity got caught up in these other sort of ethics and dispositions of the people working in places like this. And I also want to be clear that the volunteers themselves, in many cases, like, not in many cases, but in some cases, were also patients and were also patients of the very places they were volunteers. And had themselves, some of them, this was a way into a sort of sense of community again. So actually, last time I was there, I was like, there were more volunteers than patients for a while. And it did sort of this beg the question of who is this really for, right? I mean, it was a place to go. Like, it was a place to go and be useful again. And I have all this stuff on the sort of gendered aspects of this. Like, of course, women would go to these places because women just do that. That's what they're supposed to do. And but a lot of the men, there weren't that many, but those, they said, you know, this was something that had sort of allowed them to reclaim a sense of manhood and the sense of masculinity of being able to work or provide, even if it was unremunerated labor. So I guess, you know, these sort of aspects of belonging and whatever are definitely really shifting and chimerical for sure. I guess I'll also just say that, like, the people who I encountered at the social pharmacies were people who most of the time, like, they already were suffering long before the debt crisis. So all the interviews I did with people, very few people said, like, oh, we were fine until just a few years ago. Like, these were people who had been longtime outsiders, whether, you know, long-term Albanian immigrants to Greece, as I mentioned, single mothers, people with severe mental health issues that hadn't been addressed, like, since the 80s and 90s. So it's, in some ways, the social clinics, like, picked up this kind of scattering of people who had already been suffering, but were suffering way, way more.
Yeah, there are lots of interesting threads there, but I'm going to move on to other questions. Maybe we'll come back to some of those points. First, Anni Kayanus.
Thank you, Heath. That was really interesting. I'm Anni, I'm based here in Helsinki. And I was really interested in what you were saying about this talk around solidarity. But before I ask my question, my first tiny question is, and I'm sorry if I missed this, but I'm not familiar with the solidarity literature, so huh? But off the top of my head, if I think of what is solidarity, I would think of it as being together in the face of something or against something or something like that. But you probably have a definition.
Well, so, I mean, I guess I'm really working. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there was actually an earlier slide. Let me see. It was a nice way of framing solidarity. Like, solidarity and struggle is our strength. Okay, so very much, at least in my field context, very much associated with, like, the class struggle, right? And sort of very explicitly attached to that kind of class-based way of seeing, of approaching social struggle, right? And I would say also to the point where there was a kind of elision of difference in terms of other forms of difference, whether gender or race or national background in certain contexts, I would say this idea that solidarity solves everything. I guess, you know, I try to take solidarity much more just as a kind of emic concept that people enlist in different ways. And, you know, that would be the more ideologically, I think, consistent or vision that would be represented in the literature. But I also heard solidarity talked a lot about as this kind of medicine, a kind of a healing way of intervening into the social realm by bringing people in, by trying to repair those social connections that had been fragmented. And so I guess I'm not somebody who, like, of course I admire solidarity and the solidarity work, but I'm definitely not coming in with my own, like, imposed idea of what solidarity is. I'm really just working with what it means in these contexts, for sure. But of course, there's a long history of solidarity as a concept, right? And a political framework for thinking about class struggle. So
yeah.
We're informing people in the field. Yeah. Did I answer the question? Sorry.
Yeah. Thanks very much. I guess my comment follows up on that a little bit, just that thinking of solidarity as a form of cooperation, and then this talk that revolves around this form of cooperation. So in the course of cooperation, like, gossip is a kind of social vigilance. It's also about advertising yourself as a good collaborator or good cooperator. And the gossip, the targets of the gossip, or those who are being criticized, they are criticized on the basis that they don't share these shared values that are the basis of our cooperation. And I was thinking about, and then at the same time, highlighting that we, through the gossip, that we do share these values, and yeah, therefore I am a good collaborator. And so I was thinking that this talk around this bureaucratic talk about bad citizenship, and then this gossip on the streets, they are not, in that sense, they are not that different from each other. Both could be classed as gossip in the course of kind of cooperation and kind of social vigilance. So that was my comment.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I absolutely, right. They are kind of, they're both forms of gossip in the sense of, yeah, that vigilance. Thank you. That's really helpful.
That's a very interesting point. Andreas Bieler.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Andreas Bieler from the University of Nottingham in the UK. Thanks a lot for that very fascinating talk. I've got one question in relation to your very strong focus on bureaucratization. And I think if one, I mean, Greek bureaucracy may be complex. I can't say that, whether that's correct or not. But really what happened in Greece, was it not that it was this kind of massive austerity imposed from the outside, which led to enormous cuts in the Greek healthcare system? And because of these cuts, suddenly loads of people fell out of the public healthcare provisions. And then those solidarity clinics emerged as a response to these cuts in order to care for those people who had fallen through the net. And so, of course, then in 2016, Syriza turns around and says, okay, now everybody can go to the public healthcare system because we bring in a new law. But actually, there was no new money which was put into the healthcare system. And so people, rather than being worried about having to enter the bureaucratic machine, perhaps they simply reflected on the fact that actually, yeah, officially I'm allowed to go now, but considering that there's no money for the public healthcare system, if I go there, there won't be any treatment for me. Not because of the bureaucracy, but simply because of all the austerity cuts and the consequences.
Okay, so go ahead.
Your response to that, please.
Okay, of course, absolutely. And I didn't, just for the sake of time, I didn't sort of run through all of the ways in which austerity impacted the healthcare system, but I mean, and everything else. but I mean, we're talking massive cuts, massive loss of personnel, supplies, et cetera. And it was not, I would say, the most, you know, luxurious healthcare system before, but for sure, like, it was there. And my sense is that, you know, in it was interesting because when I first started doing research in Greece, this was 2004. And so everyone, like, this was the good times. Things were good. Like, there was all the dreams and, right, people still had really negative accounts of public hospitals and the Greek state. And so I remember asking people, why are people so upset about cuts to something that they already apparently didn't like? And I think a lot of people were realizing that actually there had been a social state. There had been a pretty highly functioning one, as well as a pretty good, decent public healthcare system that people missed. However, and so, this is not to diminish the effects of austerity in the healthcare, in the realm of healthcare. However, having done these sort of care-seeking interviews of people that went back sometimes, in many cases, like 15, 20 years, there was this sort of, with the increasing sort of, I would say, turn towards the private, okay? So if people could pay for it, they would go for their primary care, right? So they're to a private clinic. You know, women would go to private gynecologists. This was a very, I mean, if you could pay for it, and this was not like upper class people. These were working class people, okay? So that's the first thing. I would say the second thing that I think is really key here is that people did start going to the public hospitals. This is really interesting. Like, they did start, like, they stopped going to the social, people started going to the public hospitals. So, of course, I'm only seeing it on one side, okay? Maybe one could argue that they had successfully turned away everybody in need who, like, then was lost. But actually, that's not what I've heard. So I think in a lot of cases, people simply hadn't even visited a public hospital, right? And so also there was a sort of reframing of local clinics. So in Vidonas, for instance, there was a local clinic in Vidonas that more and more people had access to it. And so they were actually able to go there. So interestingly, in this sense, from what I understood, from certainly the accounts I had in the field, the new law did have these effects. Not to say it was perfect. It definitely was not perfect, but it did have the effect of of sort of pushing people to actually go to these public services and receive care there. Now, the problem was that pharmaceuticals became remained a major issue, because even with the new law, you still have to pay like a participation fee or a copay, which might be like €5, it might be €1, it might be €7, okay, which is like the difference between what the state codifies the medicine is costing and what it actually costs at the pharmacy, right? So those issues, like if you're taking 7 to 10 medicines and you don't have a job, that was a major issue. And so the social clinics at that point, like basically since 2017-18, I think the major function has primarily been pharmaceuticals. So I don't know if I've addressed your question. I don't want to just diminish it, but at the same time, I do think it's interesting that, I mean, there were these long-standing concerns with going to the public hospital. It had been like since at least the 90s, 2000s, from what I understood, people preferred the private system for a lot of reasons. And it was largely related to these issues of delay in time, delay in access, like lack of continuity in care, all things that are real. And yet at the same time, they sort of got blown out of proportion, I think, with this sense of graphophobia. And I will say that, I mean, graphophobia, like this is like a defining aspect in sort of Greek ways of talking about the state. I won't say that it's like, there's no state, like then apartheid, there's no state. Or like, there's all sorts of this discourse about like, oh, what state, you know, and when the state is talked about, it's usually talked about as like, you know, an aggressive or scary force, like in terms of its police face and other things. So I would say it's a pretty dominant discourse that I think, as Sarah earlier said, was like, you know, attached to, I mean, oftentimes it extends to the entire population. And then I would go to some of these bureaucracies and have a perfectly fine experience myself, but it's part of the discourse about the state and the state image for sure.
Okay, thank you.
I see your name. Do you have a Greek connection?
No, it's German. it's the same as in Greek.
Correct me, please, you know, as a non-Greek, I do have no Greek connection by blood.
Great, thank you. Now, Mari, and then Sirpa.
Yeah, hi, my name is Mari, and I'm a PhD student here in Helsinki.
Hi, Mari. Sorry.
Hello, yeah. Yeah, I've got a question, or more like invitation to elaborate on one of the points you brought up in the earlier part of your talk, and that kind of came up again when you were responding to Sarah, which is the apolitical in the political and gender of the political. And I guess there's all kinds of approaches to this, from, you know, whether healthcare has been established as like a feminine sector from kind of beginning, which in Mongolia's case, it's one of the rare ministries that gets a female head once in a while that's really rare otherwise, and so on. And yeah, I was just thinking, what is your approach to this apolitical, in the political, like, would it be kind of on a like analysis level? Would it be how your interlocutors were outlining this, or on a kind of a macro political level? But yeah, just an invitation to elaborate. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. And thank you. This is a chapter, actually, I've gotten to that chapter of like just written the ethnographic part. And so this is really helpful to think about. But also, if you have any suggestions, like I've got this whole reading list I have to sort of get through and start thinking about it in a more systematic fashion. So but I guess one of the things I've been looking at the sort of gendered ways in which precaritization plays out. So that's part of it, and sort of what seemed to be like a healthy populace and the gendered aspects of what that means. And so, and I will say that I'm new to the masculinities literature, but I'm sort of diving into it a bit more strongly right now, because I would say two figures, two sort of paradigmatic figures that became sort of powerful for illustrating like the social decline, or the decline of the Greek populace and the Greek nation that was happening under austerity. And I guess the first is the Greek old person looking through the trash, okay, whether a man or a woman, like early in the morning, people would be like, oh, the old people, their grandparents, and they're looking through the trash, and this is what we've come to. The other, in my research, was like the unemployed man who was depressed and studying and watching television all the time. And like, so this figure, this sort of depressed man watching television, was sort of, people were saying, you know, I'm going to die if I become like that. Inactivity, the sort of emasculation of Greek, of this aspect of Greek society under austerity, was also accompanied by the lack of Greek men in the coffee shop. So this goes back to old like Greek ethnography, but also, you know, the idea that social isolation, with those fragmenting of social ties, you will die. And in fact, you know, like I have some really powerful stories about, you know, interviews with men, but also with women who talked about having to leave their husbands or tolerate husbands in this way. So with that as kind of the backdrop, I then sort of started to look at the way that the solidarity networks started sort of trying to bring people in or activate them. I think that was the sort of enliven them. And I realized I was super critical, I think, in some of my data today, but like I could give you so many other stories that are stories of power, you know, powerful and meaningful social relations that were generated in these spaces. So I think, you know, I have a lot of accounts of men in these field sites. There were also the men who would commit suicide in a public fashion. So these different sort of like Greek masculinity, very, 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 very much at risk. And in the meantime, women are in the background doing all the work, of course, right? And this was a sort of assumption that actually like, oh yeah, like women do 1,000 jobs because they have to, and that's just kind of normal. And so there are accounts of women who sort of had to take over all the work of the household, the idea that like they were going to be, that they were in charge of building up citizens who, you know, children who they could send back into society and be proud of. And so women became framed increasingly as kind of the caretakers, is that even a word? Caretakers of the public good and citizenship, which is not typical, right? So I think there was beneath like this kind of overt politicized ideological vision of solidarity, okay, which was very, I think, masculine in the sense that it was like in the public sphere, it was overtly politicized. There were all of these much more like work of care that was explicitly gendered, that was actually making this work happen behind the scenes. And so, you know, just from a labor perspective, like, you know, you usually get someone like Vangelis, who's like, you know, all for one for all, like out there and sort of, you know, lecturing at everybody about the need to be politically active and that how solidarity has to be politicized to have any effect. And in the meantime, you know, you have people sort of like cleaning the pharmacy and rolling their eyes and kind of getting on with the work of solidarity. And so I think there's also that. It's undeveloped. And so that's why I really need to think more about this like gendering of the political sphere. And, you know, I think there's also the danger of going into these kind of old school like Greek boxes of gender that I certainly don't want to do, but which are very powerful still. And I would say like powerful symbolically and in the sort of ways in which people told their stories of precaritization, but also survival. So if you have any thoughts and want to send me any literature, I'm open. I'm open, very open to it, because this was my next project or my next chapter. So
yeah, no, there's a lot of interesting things actually about the political and how to understand what is political in contemporary context, but also Mari's work, the person who just asked you the question, has a lot of overlaps with what you're doing, and she found some very interesting things in terms of the relation between the state and treatment in Mongolia. Anyhow,
fascinating. Well, I'd love to hear about it, hopefully.
We've only got time for one more question, or maybe two if we make the questions quick. Sirpa followed by Fedra Duzina Bakalaki, who I think you know. And she'll have the final question. So make both your question, Sirpa, and your answer, Heath, quick, so that we can get Fedra in before I have to stop.
Okay, I'll try to be super fast. I'm Sirpa Tervonen, I'm a professor of anthropology here, and I'm not an expert on Greek society and culture, but I was surprised how dominant the state, the role of state or the state image is in Greece, considering that there has been all these austerity measures. One would think that people wouldn't be bothered with state so much. Like I work in India, so the state is not so central there, although there are many of the same problems there. And secondly, I was thinking that it seems that there is a tension between people's ideas of solidarity and their quest to build social relationship through voluntary work, that there is an interesting tension there. So maybe that's my question, or maybe it's more of a comment. But that's. Thanks.
Can we have both the questions and then I can try to respond? Does that help? Or
yeah. Yes. So Fedra, go ahead and ask your question too. And then you connect.
Thank you so much for the paper. I think you did a wonderful job at explaining how bureaucracy has been a very powerful frame of reference and action and meaning both before and after the crisis. And I wonder whether you encountered at all the view that somehow the fact that that healthcare is so highly bureaucratized within the context of solidarity also means that we are dealing with business as usual. So I wonder here whether bureaucracy somehow serves to give people it serves to give them the feeling that somehow things continue to be familiar, they continue to be recognized. People still have ways of navigating, you know, the bureaucrats, the state, and so on, despite the urgency of the Greek economic crisis. So here I'm wondering whether we can actually think of bureaucracy as a very powerful a form of cultural intimacy that somehow serves to help people navigate the crisis itself and all the grievances involved. Thanks.
I'm just going to take that as a really helpful comment, Fedra. Thank you. Absolutely. It's excellent. Yeah, I'm seeing it sort of as this kind of problematic thing. But actually, yes, bureaucracy is this kind of like vernacular of like Greek ways of dealing with service provision and talking about it, gossiping about it. I mean, it's a way in which people encounter each other and build socialities as well as undermine them. So I think that's really helpful. Thank you. And I think this actually gets back to Sirpa's comment. Yes, there is, I think, an obvious, a very clear tension between the project of solidarity and building social relations. But, you know, I think oftentimes the ways in which social ties emerge in these spaces, like, is definitely like it's not planned. it's more of the sort of serendipitous aspects of what happens when people come into encounter around these issues. I also just about the state, and I think this goes a little bit back to Fedra's comment. I think, you know, also the state in Greece, is a focus of a lot of discussion and debate. I think in part because, and particularly under austerity, because that was the thing that was under threat, and the state, the Greek state, has often, you know, for a long time been sort of marked as ways in which Greece has not been European enough. It's been, you know, Southern, Ottoman, Byzantine, all of these kinds of things that sort of mark it as somehow apart from the functioning welfare state, like that the people imagine exists in the European North. So, you know, the state and bureaucracy is also one of the venues in which, like, Greece's position in Europe and globally, I think, is also sort of navigated and negotiated, right? And it was all about, like, the state didn't pay their, the state was in debt and they lied about it, you know? So I think that's one of the reasons it got so much attention and it gets so much attention too. And it is aspects of cultural intimacy. So can I say thank you all? And I this magic thing, I meant to ask if you think it's effective or not. It's a new thing. So it may be completely ineffective, but you can tell me later, hopefully if I get to Helsinki as I hope to get.